You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 25th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
What it is.
How is everyone doing?
Steve, I have bad news for you.
What's that?
I am formally out of hard drive space.
Is that right? Yeah,
well, I have 2 4-terabyte drives that Steve and I got that is housing all of our raw footage on pretty much everything we've ever done.
8 terabytes.
Yeah, it's formally full.
It goes fast.
I
produce like 10 gigabytes a week just doing the show.
I tell you, we're going to see the yottabyte in our lifetime. I know it.
Yotta. No.
Yes.
So we've been cleaning out my basement, which is going to be the new Skepta Lair. That's where we're going to be doing the 10-hour show in May.
The bunker.
Yeah. Don't forget, we're going to have a 10-hour live video audio streaming event on Saturday, May 2nd, starting at noon. So keep an eye out for that. We'll have more details coming. But that's going to be in my basement. So we've been cleaning it out. And I came across some floppy disks that are like literally 40 years old.
1.44 megabytes.
The 5 1/4. Baby.
Yeah, 5 1/4 floppy disks.
Oh, wow. 1982. Yeah.
And then I had the 3.5-inch disks. That was a big, right? Those are hard cased, smaller and higher capacity disks.
Yep.
Those are the ones that were 1.44.
Flopping those things back and forth. Yeah. Now everything's on hard drive and thumb drive and solid state drives.
What's on those old disks? So do you have something that you can pop in and?
Well, they're mainly Word documents of stuff I was working on, which fortunately I've sort of carried forward every time I like get a new hard drive. I carry everything forward from the previous iteration, but I have at times gone into those like really old files and a lot of them are almost worthless now. Nothing can really read them at best.
Oh, you can't open. Like 10-year-old files. I was reading about one of the guys that founded Google was saying that he says we're going to be in a huge data loss in 20 years.
Oh,
and that's
gosh.
What he was talking about, that we won't be able to have backward compatibility. You can't open, you know, different types of files, even like a Word document from 10 years ago you can't open it on today's Word.
Yeah. At best, you get a jumble of nonsense, but somewhere in the middle there is the raw text that you can pull out without formatting. That's like the best you could do.
Yeah, but what about pictures? You know, that's
a forget it.
Animal.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot of data that's going to be lost.
Yeah, but he wants to archive it in a way, like, and archive the way to translate it. You know what I mean? So that we don't lose a century of data because it's not backward compatible.
Is that more tech? I suppose it's more technically complex than it sounds.
Probably.
Well, really, it's saving all the different ways to decode that information. In essence, it's just an algorithm that knows how to read the different types of formats. So a JPEG has a specific way that it's constructed and deconstructed digitally.
Isn't it just a matter of, you know, just maintaining, like, can't you just have one piece of software that knows how to read everything that's ever been done in the past? I mean, right? I mean, how hard would it be to keep the information necessary to read a Word file from 1982.
It's not just like, oh, I need to download this converter. It's more like the operating system has to be able to play with it as well. It is complicated.
Yeah.
It's complicated enough where one of the people at Google is worried about it and is talking about it.
Yeah. Well, I threw out my floppy disk. So I kept them for long enough just for sentimental value, and now I just don't have room for that stuff anymore.
Trash.
So Jay, 8 terabytes, dude, what are you going to do about maintaining that? I mean, you know how hard drives are. I mean, after a few years, they are almost done, essentially. So every 2 years, you're just transferring it to new hard drives?
Yeah, I've read studies about, you know, how long I think this company is one of the big cloud companies, and they've been keeping very good records of the different manufacturers' brands and how long the hard drives last, and like Western Digital rates very well. But still, there's like a quick drop off. So, you know, they're trying to hold on to the hard drives as long as they can before they predictably are going to die. So I agree with you, Bob. My long-term strategy right now is I have online backup, and, you know, I've been experimenting with different companies. I've had a couple fail me miserably, but without a disaster happen, just, you know, either charging me too much or they can't handle that size of a, you know, 8 terabytes of data. You know, what can I do, right? There's lots of things you could do. You could put it on some type of NAS storage and then just tuck it away and keep multiple copies. You know, there's all different types of strategies.
But fortunately, I mean, you can get a 4 terabyte internal hard drive for like $150-$200. So getting a couple $100 worth of hard drives every couple of years for a business like what we do, that's not that big a deal, just to make sure that we constantly have our data backed up on fresh hard drives, you know? Maybe somebody out there knows more than we do. They can make us some more suggestions, but right now we're just buying hard drives. Yeah, probably. All right. Well, we have a great interview coming up later in the show with Timothy Caulfield, who, among other things, is the author of Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? He's going to answer that question for us.
Yep.
But first, Bob, you're going to tell us about this week's forgotten superhero of science.
Yeah, this was a fun one to research. I'm going to cover this week Mary Anning, who was a fossil collector and paleontologist. She discovered and prepared key fossils and influenced scientific thought about the ancient Earth and extinction and paleontology itself.
Yeah, I read about her, Bob. They called her a fossilist. I've never heard that term before.
Yes, very good. I came across the same term, and I was very impressed with it. Anning was born in 1799, and she came from a fossil-hunting family, which sounds like the good basis for a TV show, I think. But,
but Land of the Lost,
right?
That's awesome.
They sold.
So her whole family did it, like, yes. Siblings and as well as all of her parents?
Her whole family, they did it to actually survive. Apparently the economy was bad, and they actually used that money to actually eat and do stuff like that. But they sold their fossils to museums and scientists, but not only that, they also sold them to European nobles who had private collections.
Cool.
Now, her father died when she was young, and she had to really step up this family business. But she and her brother found an ichthyosaur fossil when she was 12 years old. Now, this wasn't the first one found, but it was the first one that was brought to the attention of the London scientific community, and it caused a sensation. And she was only 12 when this happened.
Wow.
Check this one out, though. Years later, she discovered the very first plesiosaur, first one ever found, and that caused a sensation as well. And among other insights that she made, she discovered the true nature of these curious objects called Bezier stones that she found or people found in the abdomen region of ichthyosaurs. She realized that these stones were fossilized excrement, which were later called coprolites. So she really knew her shit, apparently. So although now, Anning, she did not have, there was no formal training. She did not have any formal training, but she was described by one person as understanding more of the science of this specific science than anyone in the kingdom. She was incredibly knowledgeable. And of course, her father was teaching her how to do all this stuff since she was a kid. She knew her stuff. Yet, despite this, all this knowledge and all this home training, if you will, for both the ichthyosaur and plesiosaur, Anning had she not only discovered these multiple specimens, not just one. She discovered multiple key specimens of both of these different types of creatures, but she also painstakingly cleaned them and prepared them, and sometimes she even drew sketches of them that scientists used when they were discussing them with other scientists. She did it all. And unfortunately, and all too frequently, the scientists that were writing papers about what she found and doing formal presentations about what she discovered made no mention of her. They would not even mention her contribution.
Ugh.
Why? Was it because she was a little kid?
At this point,
she was an adult. And, well, it's a combination of things. You know, women at that time were not important, scientifically. You were lucky if you were even literate, let alone, acting like a scientist.
When they were interested in science, there was like acceptable avenues. It was acceptable for women to be specimen collectors, but not to do anything too thinky. You know what I mean? They couldn't do actual science, but if they wanted to go out and collect stuff that then the men could describe and get the credit for it, that was fine.
Yeah. I mean, later on in her career, people definitely were giving her more respect, and they were saying, hey, by the way, this was found by Mary Anning. And she did get some of that credit, but there were lots and lots of instances. I counted six where they just did not even mention her to the people that were presenting what she had found, and not just found. Like I said, she completely cleaned it, prepared it, did all that stuff. So so her discoveries, though, this is very important. Her discoveries came at a time when many scientifically adept people at that time period did not believe in just basic things like extinction or the vast age of the Earth.
Yeah.
So the fossils at that time, the early fossils, a lot of them were just they were unusual. They were things like mammoths. And so people would often just say, oh, you know, these creatures still exist. They just exist somewhere that's unexplored and we just haven't found them yet. But her discoveries and those of other people showed the scientists that animals this foreign really did they existed long ago, and they are not alive now. And that was very important thing. So, but not only extinction, though, she also helped show that an ancient Earth was possible. Earth was not 6,000 years old, yeah, as many, many people mm-hmm. believed. As you can imagine, in the early 1800s, the vast majority Forget of people it. Believed the Earth was 6,000 years old. She helped force the realization that the age of reptiles was real. It actually entered people's consciousness that, yes, these animals lived and dominated the planet for many millions of years, and they ruled over mammals. Mammals were just, you know, not important at all at that time. And then another thing that came as a surprise, she was a key early player in geohistorical analysis, using fossils to reconstruct extinct organisms and environments, which later became, of course, paleontology. She was a key player in the rise of paleontology itself, which I found incredibly impressive. So, read up on Mary Anning, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing ocular cavities in basal ichthyopterygia. She needs to be remembered.
Bob, are you aware that a new ichthyosaur has been named Ichthyosaurus anningi after Mary Anning?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Yes,
Just recently.
I was, and that was really good, because earlier in her career, after she was well established, that people did notice that it was really kind of ridiculous that people that she gave fossils to had these creatures named after them, but not her.
She's going to be psyched to hear that.
Yeah, right.
So it's
spike her up.
This,
but there are a lot now, Steve. There are a lot.
Someone channel her. Tell her.
There are a lot that have been named in her honor at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she deserves this one because it's
absolutely
an ichthyosaur. But
yes,
this ichthyosaur was sitting in a museum drawer and was rediscovered in 2008 by another self-taught paleontologist, Dean Lomax. Dean Lomax noticed that there were some differences. This one has some anatomical distinctions that are different from any other ichthyosaur. So he was able to identify it as a new species and named it after Mary Anning, which is very, very nice.
Awesome.
The ichthyosaurs are a very interesting group. I wrote about them in our science news page, so take a look at that if you're interested. All right, let's go on to some news items. Jay, there is a new scientific report about the safety of marijuana.
In the United States, guys, as you know, cannabis, marijuana, weed, whatever you like to call it, it's been thought to be a very dangerous and arguably became the most fought against drug, right? You know, we had the whole reefer madness thing going on, right? The war on drugs, exactly. Over the past 20 years, though, a lot of opinion has changed significantly, in fact, to the point where a lot of states in the United States are now legalizing marijuana and even releasing some people that are in prison that have certain levels of convictions, right?
Alaska recently legalized it.
Very recently, yeah.
So a recent study tested how deadly are several common and popular drugs. And it did a side-by-side comparison with some very interesting results. The study was published in the journal Scientific Reports, which is a subsidiary of Nature. Steve, I'm sure you've heard of that one.
Mm-hmm.
The drugs they tested were cocaine, jack, tobacco, alcohol, cannabis, ecstasy, meth, and heroin. Guys, take a guess which drug was the most deadly. Evan, please start.
Well, I thought about that before I actually saw it, and I would have guessed meth would have been probably near the top, if not the top, but it turns out I'm wrong.
Bob?
Tobacco.
Steve?
No, any physician knows alcohol is an extremely toxic drug. It wrecks people.
So in order of the most deadly, guys, you guessed well, alcohol, then heroin, then cocaine, Jack, tobacco, ecstasy, meth, and cannabis at the very end of the list. Now, the amazing finding was that cannabis was far and away not even near the other drugs. In fact, they found that cannabis is 114 times less deadly than alcohol. Now, that's, you know, I know that just sounds like a number, but when you see the chart, and alcohol is in the, you know, deadly slice, which is all the way to the left, cannabis is all the way to the right, which is, you know, very profoundly not that deadly.
In those statistics, for example, is it considered that for people behind the driving under the influence of alcohol die in crashes versus people under the influence of marijuana dying in crashes? Is that like a fair kind of comparison that's taken into consideration?
No. I don't think they went there. No, I think they were just studying its biological effects.
And okay, so it's how it directly affects the human body.
So, Jay, are you saying that cannabis is the gravity of drugs?
Yes, it is the weakest of the drugs tested, Bob. Very good.
By far. Very good, Jay. You got that. You've been listening.
I've been listening to you in particular. And, Bob, you're my hero. You're somebody's hero.
Did you ever know?
Steve, a few weeks ago, you mentioned what was that, the DL50 test?
LD50.
The LD50 test. And they were using that methodology, or they were using that as a scale to see which drugs were the most deadly.
They were using another measure too, not just the LD50, BMDL10, which is the dose that gives you a 10% increase in the risk of dying. The authors are careful to point out that the only thing they're comparing here is the relationship between the dose typically used and the dose that'll kill you.
Right.
That's what they're looking at. They're not looking at all of the effects of the drug. And even in the discussion, the authors say, this does not mean that regularly using heroin doesn't have horrible health effects.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that the typical dose that's used, you know, in relationship to the dose that's likely to be fatal. And that's where, you know, cannabis is very safe from that point of view because it doesn't cause a lot of acute toxicity. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't say anything about the long-term effects of chronic exposure. They're not really looking at chronic exposure, just
right, which could have a lot of profound effects.
Liver failure.
Yeah. Right, or cannabis could have emotional and psychological effects as well or whatever. But so cannabis was the only drug out of the lot that had a low mortality risk. All the others had a relatively high or high mortality risk. Surprisingly, ecstasy and meth were the second and third least deadly. Now keep in mind, they were very far away from cannabis, but still they were a lot less deadly than alcohol and tobacco. Alcohol is so bad, guys. It's more dangerous than heroin. It's really, really, really bad.
Well, when you think about it, people drink toxic amounts of alcohol. When you're drunk, right, you're essentially, like, if
poisoned,
you think of alcohol as a drug, you're overdosing on alcohol deliberately in order to get the toxic effects. So people actually push alcohol to toxicity as part of recreational use. Does that make sense? So it's actually not that far from there to dying of alcohol poisoning.
It's important to state, guys, again, like Steve said, this isn't an invitation to go buy a bag of weed and smoke yourself into Spicoli land. you know, there's a growing mindset that since marijuana is natural, that it's safe. And the word natural is almost meaningless when we talk about safety. That would be like me saying that naturally occurring chemicals are safe or safer than non-naturally occurring chemicals. And that's bullshit.
Okay, let's move on. Have you guys heard of phantom acupuncture?
Yes, I have.
Is that a new play by Andrew Lloyd Webber? That guy.
So this is, I've heard of placebo acupuncture and sham acupuncture. Now we have phantom acupuncture. So listen to this. Okay. This is what some researchers did.
Sounds redundant, but all
right. Right. Well, I think that was the point. You know that we can induce the experience of a phantom limb in a laboratory with pretty good reliability now.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
The procedure is actually pretty simple. Let's say you're sitting in front of a table and one of your arms is on top of the table, the other one is under the table, and they're both sort of covered with a blanket. And then there's a mannequin or a rubber arm on top of the table over your arm that's under the table, right? You get that?
Yep.
So it looks like you have two arms on the table, but one is a rubber arm with your real arm being hidden under the table. And then while you're looking at your arms, if somebody strokes the rubber arm in the same place and time that they stroke your real arm, you will feel and see the rubber arm being stroked. That's how your brain determines that you own the different parts of your body, right?
Steve, the brain overcomes the actual, I'm not sure what to call it, illusion that the rubber arm is made of rubber, right? It's able to sort of like look past that.
The question has some assumptions in it that I think I need to address. Let me just back up and just explain how the brain generates the sense of ownership in the first place. It's an active process. And essentially what it's doing is comparing multiple different sensory streams at once. What you see, what you feel, what your motor planning is doing, is the, are you, the parts of your body doing what you want them to do? And then there are circuits that are sort of comparing that information, and they create the subjective sensation that we own the parts of our body and that we control the different parts of our body. There's actually a module in the brain called the ownership module that gives you the feedback that you own a part of your body. What happens in like a phantom limb is that the ownership module still exists, but even if you've had a limb amputated or it's dead, and so it still is creating the sensation that you own this limb, even if it's not there. And I know we've talked on the show about supernumerary phantom limbs, where people have had like after a stroke and part of their body is paralyzed, but their ownership module is still functioning. The ownership module may create a phantom limb because it's being deprived of the normal feedback that it gets. And so people have this hallucinatory limb. You know, they think they have this extra arm that they feel like they own and can control.
Now, Steve, but also when somebody loses a limb, they can have phantom pain, which is an odd phenomenon as well.
Right. One wrinkle to that is like sometimes people, their phantom sensation, like say they've had their arm amputated, they might feel like their fist is clenched and they're digging their fingernails into their palm of their hand and it's painful. One of the treatments for that is to put a mirror up so that they're looking at their intact limb, but their brain sees it as their missing limb. And then they open their hand, right? So it's like visually signaling the brain that they're opening the phantom limb. And that often works. It takes the pain away.
Silly brain.
Yeah. So anyway, so now we get back to the acupuncture. If you do this in somebody and they successfully own the rubber hand because of the tactile illusion, then they give acupuncture to the rubber arm, right? So that's phantom acupuncture. And what they found is that the brain
lights up.
The brain lights up in the fMRI scan. It responds in a way similar to acupuncture of an actual limb. When doing acupuncture of a phantom limb.
Oh my gosh. Isn't that kind of a case closed kind of scenario? That's it.
Steve, are you saying that the rubber arms actually have meridians inside?
Yeah, so obviously it's
that's exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, Bob, if you have a AAA battery in it, yes.
Yeah, it's beyond absurd to think that there's chi and meridians and life force flowing through this rubber arm. But it emphasizes the fact that how subjective these sensations are, and that, you know, even just visually tricking the brain is enough to get it to respond in a way that it thinks it should be responding, right? It's sort of generating the expected experience, even when nothing is actually physically happening. In this case, you know, this is a pretty darn good control. The acupuncture is happening to a rubber arm, so it can't be doing anything physiologically. The only real thing that's happening is that you're seeing it happen to an arm that your brain has been tricked into thinking is part of you. So, yeah, isn't that fascinating? Now, I always have to throw in the normal caveats here. This is one study. fMRI studies are really tricky to do. You know, it'd be interesting to see this replicated and to see how far we can take this. But yeah, this is, I found this very interesting. Now, of course, some people will say, well, okay, so the acupuncture works by tricking the brain into thinking you're not having pain. So what? You're still not having pain. But that still gets you back to it's just an elaborate placebo. You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that you can treat cancer with acupuncture. That's always the problem I have, you know, is that they're using the how easily our perception of pain can be manipulated to say that there's something specific about acupuncture that has a specific effect and the underlying philosophy is correct and all that stuff. And therefore, I'm going to use it to treat high blood pressure and cancer and mumps and all this other nonsense. But meanwhile, studies show that just pain is incredibly distractible. You know, if you just look at the other arm while a procedure is being done on one of your arms, your perception of pain will be less, for example.
I do that when I get a shot in the arm. I turn away. I kind of just concentrate on some other part of my body or something. I don't feel it.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas if your attention were focused on it, it might be incredibly painful. But this pretty much undercuts the notion that therefore it must have a specific physiological effect, or chi is real and meridians are real. You know, there's no support for that in any evidence.
So what's left? I mean, the whole acupuncture paradigm falls entirely apart as far as I'm concerned.
It won't do anything. Evan, nothing is going to change.
Oh, I understand that. It's not going to convince the true believers. But that part of their argument is now entirely gone. It's over.
Yeah. So this wasn't looking at a clinical response. This was looking at just the brain response on fMRI scan. The researchers said that they want to do follow-up studies looking to see if there's a clinical response, and that will be interesting as well. And the other research has already shown that the only thing that really matters to the effect of acupuncture, right? It doesn't matter where you stick the needles. Doesn't matter if you stick the needles. Doesn't matter if it's a trained acupuncturist or somebody who was just told 10 minutes ago how to fake their way through it. None of that matters. The only thing that matters is the interaction between the acupuncturist and the patient. And the more supportive they are, the more positive they are, the better the outcome. And that's it. You could be randomly poking them with toothpicks, but if you're nice and you're positive and confident, they'll have a placebo effect. That's it.
What's next? Virtual acupuncture, in which you don't even have to touch your
right? I mean, there's therapeutic touch is virtual acupuncture, basically. Just waving your hands over somebody. It's literally there's nothing physical happening.
But they didn't call it something cool like virtual acupuncture.
Yeah, there you go, Evan. That's going to be your pseudoscience. You could do that, make $100.
I'm getting the t-shirts made now.
Virtual acupuncture.
I'd go for the multidimensional acupuncture.
Guys, quantum acupuncture.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, gosh.
That's good.
Wait, Deepak might already own the rights to that.
Yeah, that one's probably out there.
We're going to have to check on that, yeah.
All right, Evan, I understand that both liberals and conservatives can be anti-science.
What? Are you kidding, Steve? If you read Facebook, have you read Facebook lately?
Unfortunately, I do.
And an Ohio State University study, which appears or is going to appear in the Annals of American Academy of Political and Social Science in their March 2015 issue, is going to make that very point, that liberals as well as conservatives can be biased against science that doesn't align with their political views. The study found that people from both the left end of the political spectrum and the right end of the political spectrum expressed less trust in science when they were presented with facts that challenged specific politicized issues. Now, can you guess what the top two bugaboos for conservatives were?
But these are the ones that were chosen by the researchers. They weren't necessarily ones that were determined to be the big issues for Republicans.
It's a good point, Steve. Yes,
because, actually, and I make that point because the ones that were chosen by the researchers for the liberal side were nuclear power.
And fracking.
And fracking. Fracking actually is not a bad one, but you know they found an asymmetry. They did find an asymmetry, meaning that the two sides didn't respond exactly the same. Republicans were about four times more bothered by being contradicted, you know, in their beliefs than the liberals were, which is similar to the kind of stuff that Chris Mooney says, right? That the Republicans are, you know, they're more anti-science because of their basic ideology. But I have the same problem with this study that I had with the studies that he did, and that is there's an inherent asymmetry in the topics themselves. And the authors here acknowledge that. They say that, well, maybe it's just that global warming is a much hotter topic than nuclear power is. And so that's why they get more upset. So I keep wanting somebody to do this study with something like GMO. And I predict, even though that's not as cleanly left-right, because it's the anti-government people also don't like GMO. But in any case, you know, if you like the liberal anti-GMO faction, I bet you they would be as a similar type of response as the anti-AGW right side of the spectrum.
Another problem that, as long as we're onto the problems already about this particular study, you know, it's very revealing, very interesting, but it's a little too simplistic. I mean,
yeah.
There's two groups, right? Are you conservative or are you liberal? Well, that doesn't, you know, it's not a one size fits all or, you know, choice. It's not a real choice. I mean, there are lots of different issues.
The conservatives were really religious right. They really should mm-hmm. have used religious right, you know, because you're right, because like a libertarian would have had a completely different response, I think.
Right, absolutely. And some people are conservative about some things and quite liberal about other things.
Right.
It doesn't identify how they think about all issues. So it's a much, much more grayscale than they afforded here. You know, they really just used black and white, basically. So that was kind of another problem I sort of had with this, but it does go to show, and I think it's been our experience for the, you know, 10 years we've been doing the podcast and almost 20 years that we've been involved in the skeptical movement, is that there is political affiliation does not necessarily make you either more knowledgeable about science or have a better appreciation of science than not. And people mm-hmm. who are, you know, on whatever side of the political spectrum you want to place yourself on, just as susceptible to all the human frailties that are, you know, that we know exist.
Yeah.
You know, anybody can be biased.
I think what the scientific literature shows that this is tapping into some basic human psychology, you know, motivated reasoning, defending our positions, the role of ego, et cetera. It's like all these psychological studies show that there are basic psychological biases that would lead people to stick to their guns in the face of scientific evidence. And mm-hmm. the interaction with their political views is interesting. I'm not totally opposed to the idea that there's a difference between people who are ideologically conservative and ideologically liberal. I'm just not convinced by the current evidence because of this issue that these researchers bring up, that the issues themselves are inherently unbalanced. And, you know, so I need to see, they use the same topics. They use the same exact challenges that Chris Moonian did in his research, which is interesting. I mean, why hasn't anyone done this with GMOs, for example, or just try to pick issues that are going to be as emotional, as politically controversial in the current environment and to see if it really is the ideology of the people or just the intensity of the issues that's driving the difference in intensity between the two sides here. I would just be interested.
Sure. Let's see how vaccinations, you know, charts in this array. That's another example.
Although the anti-vaxxers again are kind of, they bridge right and left. They're not strictly liberal.
But the researchers in this study, Steve, chose these, I think they chose these polarizing topics, which are obviously polarizing to make their point. But here was an interesting little tidbit as well that I pulled from it, is that the issues themselves made both sides lose some trust in the science. And
one
of the researchers said that even liberals showed lower trust in science when they read about climate change and evolution, which are issues which they normally – which they agree with in the scientific community. But just reading about the topics and that they're so polarized has a negative effect on how people feel about science. And I think the media has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I agree. And we talked about other studies which show the same thing, that any polarization or controversy tends to lower confidence in the science itself. And that's why, you know, you probably should just turn off comments on certain science news sites, you know.
Oh, yes.
Because it just the negative comments or controversial comments have an overall negative effect. It's just, I think, one of the things that we're learning as we adapt to the new social media, you know, that we're dealing with.
So there you have
it. There you have it. Okay, Bob, I understand that you wrote recently about a carnivorous plant with a tiny genome. Why does this plant have such a small genome?
This was really interesting, and this is a very fascinating little bugger. A recently detailed study of the aquatic carnivorous bladderwort plant has revealed
sounds like a Wes Anderson movie. Sorry. I had to throw that in there.
Has revealed an astonishing genetic history. It has repeatedly added and deleted genes over and over again, and it now has a small but densely packed genome with more genes than plants With six times the amount of DNA. So very, very dense. So you would recognize it by, one or multiple flowers, some of them very pretty, that kind of poke out of the water. But down below, most of its mass is down under the water. It looks like an intertwined mats of these, leafless twigs. You've probably seen them many times, probably. Well, they've been studied more intensely the past few years. And most recently, there was a study published in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution. And they describe a genome that was very interesting historically, what it's gone through. And like I said in the beginning, bladderworts have repeatedly expanded and reduced their genomes. And they actually identified three distinct events in the bladderwort history where they duplicated the entirety of their genome. Bam, just duplicated the entire thing, which I find pretty amazing. I wonder if there's other precedents for that in other species. But the fact that their genome now is very small also means that they are equally adept at just removing and deleting all these extra genes as well. But the most extraordinary thing of all is that the genome for bladderwort had almost no non-coding DNA at all, so-called junk DNA. Almost none. So humans, for example, 98.5, the vast majority of our genes are non-coding, meaning that they don't obviously function to create proteins or to control other genes. They don't do any of that as far as we could tell, or anything else. Although, of course, there have been segments of junk DNA that we did find some function for, but those are the outliers. The vast majority of our junk DNA has been studied for decades, and I think you could be pretty confident in saying that it really is junk. The bladderwort, in comparison, has only 3% non-coding. So humans, 98.5. Bladderworts, 3% non-coding. So it's essentially genes from top to bottom, all the way through, with very little non-coding DNA in there. So the implications are, I think, could be interesting. Does that mean that humans, could we do fine without any of our junk DNA? Clearly this seems to be the case, for plants in general, or at the very least for this organism.
Yeah, what's most interesting is this a line of evidence supporting the notion that junk DNA really is not necessary?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Unless there's some, but we have to explore this more. Something different about the way it regulates its DNA or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's something that enables it. And also, what were the selective pressures that made its genome, or were there any that made its genome shrink down to just almost entirely coding DNA?
Yeah, not sure. Someone was speculating that that their DNA repair mechanisms are not as good as other organisms. So and that would explain the gene duplication events, but not necessarily the paring down. Check out I did a post on this. You could check that out, or just do a search for bladderwort. And the bladders themselves are just gorgeous, especially some of the micro photographs that they took of it. It's just an incredibly, you know, exquisitely detailed structure. It's really quite remarkable. So check out this guy online. It's quite fascinating.
Well, Jay, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Who's That Noisy? So last week I played a very interesting sound. Here it is. So what we're hearing is something that seems to be forever going up in pitch.
Yeah, that's a cool audio illusion.
An illusion? What?
That is an audio illusion. That's right, Steve. So that's called a shepherd's tone. Several people did write in and guess it correctly. Now, what's actually happening here is the way that sound is constructed, there's several pitches happening at the same time. Or to be more accurate, you could say that there's octaves layered on top of each other. So as one fades out, another one is fading in. So you get a constant sense of the pitch going up. And all it's really doing is going through the same scale over and over and over again. Right. So what they say is it's a superposition of sine waves separated by octaves.
A superposition.
Right. So.
Really?
Yep.
Bob. Quantum.
That's a quantum term.
Right, so, we could actually simulate it with people singing if everyone could be accurate. You could kind of simulate how it works. It's pretty interesting. And if you do listen to it, after a while, you could pick up on the fact that it is repeating itself in a way, which it is. But if you're casually listening to it, sounds like it just keeps going up and up and up and up and up. So your brain is playing a trick on you as well. You know, it's looking for the continuity of what it's hearing. So a shepherd tone.
That's the evolutionary advantage for that.
Why does there have to be one?
Oh, you say it's just a byproduct?
Comes out of the noise.
An epiphenomenon.
Yeah.
Ah.
Like all illusions. Yeah, there's no advantage to them. It's just exploiting the way our brains process information to create these interesting effects. But that is a very compelling illusion. I mean, it really does sound like it's going up a lot, you know, not just a little bit.
Yeah, without a doubt. I know. It's fun to just try to fool yourself into believing that it's continuing to go up and up and up into infinity. And you're just like, how high can it go?
Yeah, exactly. That's cool.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love it.
This week, a very, very interesting sound. This is what I consider to be like one of those, oh my God, it's a huge sound. Guess what this is? Put it to the three of you guys. Mm-hmm. Who's that noisy?
Mm. I'll need some time to think about that one. Yeah.
What is that? What is that?
The hell is that?
All right. Well, we have another installment of The Dumbest Thing I Heard This Week, which I guess is going to be the working title for a while.
Now, Steve, can I bring up things that I hear at work?
Well, it needs to be something in the public domain, I think. It is remarkably easy to come up with bits for this segment. I mean, this like writes itself. This week, we have David Tredinnick, who is a conservative member of parliament in the UK. Uh-huh. And Tredinnick says he has the solution to the rising healthcare costs in the National Health Service in the UK. And that is astrology.
Quite a sense of humor. He's a regular Stephen Fry.
Yeah. He says, I do believe that astrology and complementary medicine would help take the huge pressure off doctors.
Oh, he's serious. He's serious.
He thinks that astrology offers self-understanding to people. People who oppose what I say are usually bullies who have never studied astrology. So he's playing the you don't know the research card. He thinks astrology could be a diagnostic tool.
Yeah. Really? Okay. Well, what's his mechanism?
Jay, don't get into mechanism. Come on. What are you, crazy?
I'm just asking questions.
Jay, this guy's in parliament and you're nothing. Don't.
Criticizes the BBC for being dismissive of astrology. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dismissive of nonsense.
That's right. He took down Professor Brian Cox too. Yeah.
Criticized
his dismissive
Brian Cox.
Approach. Yeah. And racially prejudiced?
Yes. If you are opposed to astrology, you're racially prejudiced. Well, racially prejudiced. Yes.
No, you're stupid prejudiced.
So tell us, Mr. Tredinnick, what's the race that promotes astrology or that culturally came up with astrology? Tell us, please, what race we're being prejudiced against when we say that astrology is complete and utter hokum.
I think he'll say the human race. He'll say the human race.
Yeah, I'm serious. I'm not sure he knows what the word really means. I think he thinks it means something else in that context.
It's hard to know.
Guys, this guy won an election. I mean, swaths of people turned out and pulled a lever for this guy.
So in any case,
his lever was certainly pulled.
Skeptics have looked at the data for astrology. First of all, it's as Jay said, there's no possible mechanism. The idea that the apparent position of stars relative to each other or to the planets at the moment of your birth has some influence on you is pre-scientific superstition. Seriously, it's so old school, like we don't even bother talking about it anymore. I remember the first skeptics conference I went to, they had like a breakout session on astrology. There were three people in there. No one cares. It's so played out. The idea that it's cropping up again at this level, you know, a member of parliament. Astrology? Really? I mean, that's just, that's embarrassing.
Yeah, like, that's what you're going to tie your horse to? Like that one? All right. Okay. Here we go. Break out the, you know, break out the 50-year-old literature that debunks it.
All praise Zeus, I guess.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so you haven't read the research. Yeah. We know. It's just that we read it 50 years ago. So that's why David Tredinnick earns the dumbest thing I heard this week.
Well, he earned it the old fashioned way.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how many people are going to get that joke, Evan.
It's dated. Yeah, it's a bit dated.
It is a bit dated. Well, guys, we're going to take a break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Squarespace.com. I remember those days when you had to build your own website out of HTML. I made a couple of those myself.
My first website was built out of Legos. It went nowhere fast.
A lot of people, you still program with HTML, Steve. I mean, HTML is good. It's just you need to be a programmer. And that's where Squarespace comes in, because most of us don't know how to program. I do, and I know how difficult it is and how time-consuming it is. The last thing you want to have to do is learn a programming language to build a website for your business or for your blog or whatever. That's why Squarespace is such a powerful tool. You sign up with an account with Squarespace and they give you this incredible front end, a user interface to allow you to build your own websites. It's super simple. You don't need any programming skills whatsoever. And you're like literally turning things on like a store. I want a store on my site. And then, you know, you click a few buttons and you have a store on your website.
There is support available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week via live chat and email. And it's only $8 a month. And they're going to give you a free domain name if you buy Squarespace for the year. Oh, don't forget their responsive design. So it's going to scale your website to look great on any device, phone, tablet, desktop, laptop, doesn't matter.
So guys, start a trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code SGU to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for our show.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Joining us now is Timothy Caulfield. Tim, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Hi there.
Now, Tim, you're the author of two books, at least two books. Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? When Celebrity Culture and Science Clash. And your previous book, The Cure for Everything, Untangling the Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness. Are those your only two, or would you have any other books?
I've got some boring legal ones that are probably of less interest to the
audience. Okay, more
but
technical.
For the general public, those are the two.
Okay, great. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a health policy researcher here at the University of Alberta, and I like to think that we do very interdisciplinary work looking at science policy, health policy issues ranging from, you know, really everything from stem cell research to obesity policy to complementary and alternative medicine. And what we really try to do is look at what the best evidence says about a given topic and then apply that to the policy issue. And that's what really brought me into the two books that you just mentioned. You know, I've become increasingly interested really over the last decade on what the science says about particular health policy issues. And as you know, there's often a massive disconnect. So yeah. That's really what brought me into this.
Can I ask you, do you tend to take an evidence-based approach or a science-based approach?
You know what? That's a great question. It's something that I've been grappling with over the last couple of weeks. Now, I always think that I take a science-based approach, but I've been accused of taking an evidence-based approach.
Okay.
people love to draw on that literature, right? That it, you know, it talks about the problems with evidence-based medicine. But I really think of myself as a science-based scholar.
Yeah. So you'll consider the plausibility of the treatments that you're evaluating.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So tell us, answer the question in the title of your book. So is Gwyneth Paltrow wrong about everything?
Look, she's got great style, and I think she's a fine actress. And when I was younger, I think I may have even had a crush on her. But she's wrong about an awful lot. And the reason if you've read the book, you know, I don't really pick on Gwyneth that much. I talk about a lot of other celebrities, but I just think she's such a great example of the place of celebrities in our lives right now, particularly in the context of science and health and how we think of the good life, because not only does she talk about these things all the time, right, whenever she gets the opportunity, she also, it's part of her brand, right? So she's, it's part of how she markets herself to the universe. So that's why I picked Gwyneth for the title, and that's why I start the book with a little bit of some Gwyneth stories.
Yeah, like, was the book in time to catch the whole steaming her vagina?
I missed the V steam, but you know, it was happening right when I was doing my book tour. So I mean, thank you, Gwyneth. I think I owe you a check or something like that. I mean, you can't make that stuff up, right? The vagina steam. It's funny. I was talking about it in class earlier.
Hey, does she know about the book?
It's a great question. As you imagine, I get it all the time. I haven't heard from her yet. I reached out to her, reach out to her on Twitter all the time. I've reached out to her people. When I was writing the book, I got close to her, and in the sense that I talked to many people that were close to her, and they always said that, Gwyneth would love this. I'm sure she'd love to talk to you, and it never went anywhere. As you know, the book hasn't been released in the U.S. yet, so it'll be interesting to see what happens when it comes out there. I'd love to talk with her. I always joke that I'd love to sit down and have a green tea with her and tell her about all the things that she gets wrong.
How do you think she would respond? And do you have any basis for an opinion on that? Like, have you had a confrontation with any other celebrities about their nonsense?
I think that's a fascinating question. It's one I'd actually like to study, believe it or not, because I'm sure you guys think about this too. Does she really believe the stuff that she's saying? And in fact, I always thought, if I had a chance to talk to Gwyneth, I'd probably, to interview her, I'd probably only get one or two questions. I'd probably be in a scrum. And the one question I was going to ask was, Gwyneth, do you really believe the stuff that you say? Because I don't know. I wonder that about, other quacks. I wonder that about people who sell unproven stem cell therapies. I wonder that about homeopaths. Do they really believe it? And I think there's probably a continuum out there, and I suspect Gwyneth falls on the side of the continuum where belief is real.
Yeah, Tim, I agree with that. And here's my reasoning why, is because this is not primarily, at least, what she does or what she's known for. She's an actress. She's a singer. She's this amazing superstar, People Magazine and all every other week. She didn't really need to go ahead and do this. And her Hope Goop website, which, ties all these things together. It wasn't out of any sort of necessity. So what other motivation would there be if she really didn't believe in these things?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's not like she has training in this and that it's part of her self-identification, so she's got to stick with it, right? A personal philosophy. And I also, as I note in the book, I don't really blame celebrities for their position because, look, Gwyneth and all the other, particularly women, but really all celebrities, they're under incredible pressure, right, to look good, to look young. And so I think they are victims probably more than anybody, right? They've got to do whatever they can to stay youthful looking. And so that, I wonder if that's part of the process that allows them to try a whole bunch of crazy things. And then it's a slippery slope. They start telling the world about it. And then before they know it, they've got a clothing line and a cleanse product. So, yeah, I think that you're probably right.
Yeah, and of course, the audience here is not the celebrity. I mean, I don't think there's a reasonable chance you're going to convert Gwyneth Paltrow to skepticism. But we're trying to, use her as a jumping off point to educate the public about the scientific process, health claims, et cetera. But can we really have a significant impact compared to the power of celebrity?
You're one of the things that I wanted to do with this book is it's a little bit of a Trojan horse, right? Mm-hmm. I know that there is this incredible fascination with celebrity and celebrity culture. In fact, you guys are probably aware of some of the speculation in scientific literature that we may be evolutionarily predisposed to follow celebrities, and that even Edward O. Wilson talks about our love of gossip and of hearing about other people. So I think that that's one of the reasons that I wanted to write the book, because I thought it was an excuse, a Trojan horse, to really bring in this discussion about science. Are we ever going to be able to combat the power of celebrity through skepticism and teaching science? I think probably not, but I do think, and one of the things I recommend when I speak on this, I do think that the scientific community has to get more involved in popular culture, and I think that's happening. And I can, even over my career, I've seen a massive difference. People kind of used to look down on you if you were in popular culture, if you had a blog, or if you tweeted, and I think that's changed, and I think people understand that that scientists need to be part of the discussion, because, you know, if there isn't that voice out there, it's just going to be Katy Perry and Gwyneth, right? So I don't think we can ever completely compete with it, but I think we have to be part of the discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you that I think the scientific and academic community needs to be much more involved with popular culture than they are right now. And while things have improved, academia is still a mixed bag in terms of how they view academics who engage with the popular culture. It's still, we're not there yet. Let me put it that way.
I don't think we're there yet either. I think you're right. I mean, people, you know, they assume if you've written, you know, the Carl Sagan effect, right? The guy was doing great science his whole life. And I think that his, you know, you often hear how people viewed him differently as a result of the work he did. And I think that's a shame. I think that you can do both, and more people should. And the other thing that scientists should do, I think they're doing increasingly, is when they hear something inaccurate, speak up, right? And I think that is something tangible that can be done. You know, I'm fortunate I serve on a lot of scientific committees, and that's a recommendation that often comes out, you know, in the context of stem cells, for example, when scientists hear something inaccurate stated about, you know, whether it's Gordie Howe getting a stem cell treatment, mm-hmm. that they should speak up and get on the record about what the state of the science really is. And I think I'm seeing that more and more. Do you agree?
I'm seeing everything more and more, just because, you know.
That's right. Unfortunately,
the internet. Yeah. We're still, I think, drowned out by orders of magnitude in terms of just the amount of information that's out there. But despite that, we can have a hugely disproportionate impact. So, how much are you involved with regulation of healthcare in Canada?
Well, I have been involved in, you know, a variety of capacities. Been very involved in, I mentioned stem cells a couple times. I've been involved in stem cell policy here quite a bit, in genetics, and served on a variety of advisory committees. And so that's where, you know, throughout my career, you see people trying to integrate science into policy making. And it's tough sometimes, right? Because you've got to balance public desire, public perception, political issues with what the science really says. And sometimes the best response doesn't always emerge, but at least, you know, you have to have science at the table.
Did you follow the cases of the two recent cases of the little girls, both, I think, you know, native, like Six Nation girls who had leukemia and were going to a Florida clinic to receive traditional care? And, you know, that became a court case over whether or not the state could require that they take chemotherapy.
Yes, I followed that quite closely. And as a law professor, it's a fascinating case. And I was very disappointed with the result. And it's a wonderful example of how politics and law and cultural sensitivity can complicate, I'm trying to think of the right terms, you know, choosing my terms carefully here, can really complicate a decision that one would hope would be driven by the best interests of the child and by science. And what's fascinating about that case, and I don't want to get too much into the law, is there really was, you know, there really is some complicating constitutional law that was used to justify that decision. I think everyone in my community is disappointed with the results, but unfortunately now we have that precedent. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when future cases emerge.
So was that really just up to the judge, or you know, did they have discretion to go either way, or you think the laws as they are written, this is the only way that the case could have gone?
So I think it was wrong legally. I don't think that they interpreted the Constitution the way that could have been interpreted. Having said that, there was more nuance to the law than perhaps was often portrayed in the popular press describing the case. Mm-hmm. I think the judge got it wrong was claiming that this was was a cultural practice that therefore exempted it from Canadian law. You know, I think the best interest of the child should have prevailed, which has in the past in Canada and other cases. The classic example of the Jehovah's Witness cases, and there's cases in the U.S. too that are like that. So, I was disappointed, particularly since in this case the science, the clinical evidence was so clear. Right? It wasn't a situation where people were arguing to any great degree about the actual science, but it was really about the cultural practice. So again, a disappointing decision.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you're right. This is one of the most clear cases you can possibly have. You know, they almost guarantee like 85% cure with standard therapy and almost guarantee that she will die of her disease without standard therapy. So there was no scientific really debate here. I also found it very interesting, and I don't know how much this came up in the case or the press in your neck of the woods, that the quote unquote traditional healing that was being sought in both cases is some white guy in Florida peddling snake oil that has nothing to do with Six Nations traditional healing practices.
Yeah, for sure that came up, right? For sure that came up. And I found that infuriating. And of course, I think wasn't just today or yesterday he had his license pulled I don't know if we'd call it a license.
He doesn't have a license. He told him to stop practicing medicine without a license.
Yeah, exactly.
They gave him one so they could pull it.
Yeah,
there's nothing to pull. I found that really frustrating that it was portrayed that way. But you know that happens all the time, right? In complementary alternative medicine, that you know homeopathy is portrayed somehow as having this great cultural depth to it or something like that. When it was invented where, right? And so I find that very frustrating. And that was certainly the situation in this case. Just because it's an alternative practice does not mean that it's necessarily has some great cultural history to it that exempts it from scientific scrutiny.
I mean, of course, even if it were cultural, it wouldn't. I think at the end of the day, society has a responsibility to a child, and they utterly failed both of those girls. One is now dead; the other one probably will be soon, which is unfortunate. That's the bottom line. It's like, no matter what you think, the child's dead. So the story's over for her.
It's just incredibly heartbreaking. And one of the things so frustrating as a law professor is we had this string of cases that I think clearly gave the court jurisdiction to step in. This was really about cultural practice, and that's what it came down to. And I'm sure you've heard this. There was discussion amongst the media that, people shouldn't be speaking so harshly of the Native community in this regard. It was a vicious kind of debate. And the end result was just tragic.
All right. Well, Tim, you have anything, in the future that you're working on that you'd like us to talk about?
We are looking at, things like, supplements. We just finished an interesting paper on vitamin D, which is another discussion we could have. That's like a religion, and we were looking at how vitamin D was represented in the popular press as compared to what the actual scientific literature said on it, and we're looking at a couple of other things like that. And the other thing we're doing right now is looking at how science is represented on Twitter. We're looking at it in the context of things like the Gordie, stem cells, and we're using the Gordie Howe incident as an example. And the other thing that we have a paper coming out in Science Translational Medicine next month where we look at claims about how soon stem cell research is going to get to the clinic and, sort of time to the clinic. And it's always 5 years in the future, right? This trial is going to be in the clinic. So we think that's a really good example of science hype and how that can feed the science exploitation phenomenon I talked about. Because I do think scientists take a little bit of the blame for some of the phenomena we're talking about in the context of science exploitation, because there's just been so much hype on that. So that's some of the work we're doing right now. I got a great interdisciplinary team. I like to believe I just sit on people's coattails and have fun.
All right, Tim, well, it was great talking with you. Thanks for being on the show.
A real pleasure, you guys. Thanks so much for all the great work that you guys do.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. We have a theme this week.
Yeah, before you get to the theme, Steve, didn't Bob like lose the last two or three weeks in a row?
Yeah.
We all did.
No, I'm just
We've
checking
had
on
three
Bob's status,
sweeps
ours.
In a row. We had the Junior Fiction was a sweep, and then I swept 2 weeks ago and last week. That's correct.
And Steve, do you have off the top of your head, Bob, Steve, who's far and above in the lead?
Oh, Bob, you're having a great year, just not a great month, but yeah, you're having
a great year. Okay, but still way in the lead. All right, let's go.
Okay, the theme is biofuels. Item number one. In Stockholm, wild rabbits are being culled and their corpses are being burned in a heating plant in central Sweden. Item number two. A Beverly Hills plastic surgeon used the waste from his patient's liposuction to create biodiesel to fuel his SUV. And item number three. On the International Space Station, human waste is dried to reclaim moisture, and the remains are burned to produce power for the station. Jay, go first.
Okay, so in Stockholm, Sweden, you're saying here that wild rabbits are being culled, and they're burning their corpses for a heating plant in Sweden. What in the hell? Why would they kill rabbits for fuel? How many can there possibly be?
Six.
All right, that's very odd.
Procreate that quickly.
This other one is Beverly Hills plastic surgeon says here that using liposuction fat, right? When you say waste, it's biodiesel pretty much. I think the one about the Beverly Hills plastic surgeon is probably true. The third one here about the International Space Station, I think that one is science where they dry the poop and reclaim the moisture. That makes a lot of sense. So that one is definitely science. And it's between the killing of the rabbitses and the liposuctioning of the fatsises. I am going to say that the Beverly Hills one is the fiction because I don't think it's – I think that there's something illegal about taking bio waste and turning it into a fuel.
Okay, Evan.
It's cold in Sweden. Let's face it. I don't know. Do they have a rabbit population sort of problem in Sweden maybe? You know, I know they do in Australia and other places. So maybe this is a way to do away with the animals after they kill them, you know. Why? I guess if they have to cull them, they figure why go totally to waste and burn it. Although the smell of burning rabbit hair, double entendre. That's
burning hair. Yeah.
So could be. Beverly Hills plastic surgeon used the waste from his patient's liposuction to create biodiesel fuel in the SUV. Well, legal or not doesn't mean I'm not sure that has anything to do with it. But, fat as fuel? I think so. I'll say that one's right. That leaves me with the space station. Human waste is dried to reclaim moisture and the remains are burned. You're burning stuff in space? Really? Like that? Can you have fires in space? I mean, you'd have to burn waste a lot of times. I'm not sure they would necessarily want to do that, unless they store it up a lot and just do like one big burn after a while. I don't think that International Space Station one's right. I'll say that one's the fiction.
And Bob.
Yeah, the rabbit one sounds just completely whack. I mean, what the hell? Really? Seriously? It's just too ridiculous to be fiction, actually. The second one, but the biodiesel, Jay had an interesting point if that's even legal, but that is nothing compared to three. I just had such a visceral reaction to three. Jay, the space station one, I mean, Jay just kind of skipped over that last very important part of that sentence. Remains are burned to produce power for the station. And I think Evan is, his thinking is along mine. Fire in space, not good. It's like having a fire on a boat in the middle of the ocean. You want to avoid that at all costs. I mean, I'm sure they could make it pretty damn safe, but just the idea of burning something for powering the station. I mean, what kind of station is this? That's ridiculous, I think. I'm going to say that one's fiction.
Okay, so you all agree, number one, so we'll start there. In Stockholm, wild rabbits are being culled and their corpses are being burned in a heating plant in central Sweden. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah, baby.
Oh.
How? Why? Where?
Poor bunnies.
They are having a bit of a rabbit problem.
That was directly from Bugs Bunny, Bob.
Thank you so much.
Well done.
Awesome.
So they have to cull the rabbits. The rabbits are eating up all the plants in the parks in Stockholm. So they have to get rid of them. And they decided to make the most of the corpses. They freeze them, send them to a special heating plant in Karlskoga in central Sweden, and then they burn them to heat homes. Isn't that interesting?
Wow.
Of course, the animal rights activists are not happy with this. They think that they should just be like, you know, trapped and taken elsewhere. Or you could put stuff on the trees so they can't eat them or whatever. You could just eat the rabbits, make Hassenpfeffer out of them.
Hassenpfeffer.
All right, let's go on to number two. A Beverly Hills plastic surgeon used the waste from his patient's liposuction to create biodiesel to fuel his SUV. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan think this one is science. And Jay, interestingly, you say you think it's the fiction because such activity would be illegal. And you're right, it is illegal. But this one is still science.
Oh, awesome.
Woohoo!
The guy was doing it illegally. He was keeping, you're not allowed to use, apparently in California, they have a specific law that says you cannot use human medical waste in order to make biofuel. Okay. But this guy was doing it. He was saving the fat that he was sucking out of his patients, and he was using it to fuel his Ford SUV and his girlfriend's Lincoln Navigator.
Wow.
And then he fled to South America or something. He was a couple of patients accused.
Drove him, to South America.
Accused him of sucking more fat out of them than they needed. You know, of not doing a good job. And
wait a minute, the guy was maniacally over liposucking to get biodiesel.
SUV man, those things are guzzlers. Yeah. So what can you kind of tell?
I find this very unsettling.
Oh, man. This is gross.
Lipodiesel. Call it lipodiesel.
Jay, you just lost science of fiction. How do you feel?
I'm going to go to Disneyland and get measles.
Nice. Touché.
Bring some back for the family.
Which means, yeah, if you're done, the International Space Station human waste is dried to reclaim moisture, and the remains are burned to produce power for the power station. That one, of course, is fiction. But, you know, I wasn't thinking that they were, like, throwing it into a fireplace, you know.
I know.
They were shoveling it in a self-contained,
like coal into the engines of the Titanic.
Yeah, completely self-contained contraption there where you put it in there and then, you burn it for energy and it partially produces energy. And maybe if we – one day when we have to have self-sustaining space stations or ships or missions to Mars or whatever – you can't put that poop to waste, as it were. You either have to use it to regrow more food or burn it for fuel, or you do something with it. You wouldn't just jettison it. So what do you think the ISS does with the human waste?
Doesn't it package it and send it back down to the next supply ship?
Yeah, they package it with the garbage, and they let it burn up on reentry.
Okay.
What do they do with the urine?
They reclaim the water, don't they?
They filter it and drink it.
Yeah, they filter it and drink it. Do you know why they do that?
That makes perfect sense. Why?
Because they can.
Free water, hello.
Well, it's actually not. I mean, it's a good little perk that you get some extra water, but that's not why they do it. Because, you know, they could deliver as much water as they need up there. But the primary reason, I mean, that's a secondary benefit. The primary reason was they actually discovered that when they were jettisoning the urine, that little urine crystals were causing damage to the station. Especially the solar panels.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Interesting. The jettison pumps were not strong enough. They need something, you know, to really get them out into far orbit.
Or they just drink it.
Or they just drink it. Or yeah. Drink it.
Drink it.
Drink it.
Cycle it through again. Yeah.
What's this, sir?
Right. So no sweep this week. Evan and Bob, you did a good job.
Yeah, we sneezed.
Yes, baby.
Sorry, Jay.
Jay, I think you were too horrified by the whole story about
they were all the they're all funny, aren't they?
I mean, they are. They are.
Well, In a weird way, sure.
I mean, the second one sounds like an urban legend, the plastic surgeon one.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. But there's an article on it, so it seems legit.
Good job this week, guys.
Thank you, Jay.
Okay, Evan, bring us home with a quote.
Here is this week's quote. There's not a discovery in science, however revolutionary, however sparkling with insight, that does not arise out of what went before. Written by none other than Isaac Asimov.
Evan, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you like Mrs. Bogle?
I never get tired of that. It's so awesome. I don't think I necessarily need to explain exactly who Isaac Asimov was to this audience.
I hope not.
So integral to
he was a guy that
all
worked
the stuff we read as kids and the skeptical movement itself, and he was kind of important.
One of the few authors who bridged the gap between science fiction and nonfiction. Most authors need to really do one or the other. Like, the publishing companies don't want you to be both. But if you're Asimov, you can do whatever the hell you want.
That's right. Oh, about Isaac Asimov. And did you know that in 1974, Paul McCartney, I don't have to explain who he is either, he approached Isaac Asimov with an idea for a movie because he had just completed working on his Wings album called Venus and Mars, very popular album. McCartney's basic idea was about a band who discovered they were being impersonated by a group of extraterrestrials. And Asimov thought it was interesting enough to write up a treatment, and he titled it 5 and 5 and 1. His story featured parasitic energy beings who crashed on Earth and had to look for suitable hosts to continue their survival.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried the beings, they tried lizards, and then they tried cattle, but they decided on humans as the best choice. But as humans, they heard music for the first time. And so they became eagles so they could fly across the world and choose the right musicians to inhabit. I wonder which musicians they were thinking of inhabiting. Well, the story kind of went nowhere after that. I don't think Paul McCartney was.
And that was never made into a movie?
Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. So he said screw it and wrote the Robots of Dawn series instead.
Oh, I love Foundation. That series.
Yeah, Foundation.
Well, he had already written many installments of that.
When is Foundation going to be made into a movie?
Yeah, man.
Right? Oh.
I think they're actually looking into it.
I mean, they're trying to, you know, plagiarize as much as they can, you know what I mean? Like there's nary any original ideas.
No, Hollywood's
in Hollywood. But come on, the Foundation series. I mean, it's just sitting there. There's so many good science fiction series that have never been made into movies. It's unbelievable. Anyway.
I know.
Yep. Guys, there don't forget Nexus, April 9th to 12th in New York City. Bill Nye is our keynote speaker. He's also going to be joining us Friday night for the Skeptic's Guide extravaganza with George Robb.
Yeah.
And now also featuring Bill Nye. Plus we have lots of other great speakers. Check out the nexus.org, necss.org website for all the details and to register. We have a whole day of science-based medicine. We have workshops, extravaganza, a weekend skeptical conference. It's going to be awesome. Definitely.
Yeah, and you can pick what parts you want to do. You don't have to sign up for the whole conference if you can't make the weekend, or you could do one day, or you could just do the workshops. You could just come to the extravaganza. Take a look at the website to figure out what parts you'd like to go to. But I recommend you see everything because this year is going to be fantastic. Bill Nye is going to be all over the conference.
Epic.
Yep. And we haven't mentioned it in a while, but you could become a supporting member of the SGU. Go to our website, theskepticsguide.org, click on the Become a Member button, and you'll see how to join the SGU membership. If you become a premium member, that's only $8 a month, you get access to all of our premium content. We upload all kinds of additional audio segments. There's a couple of videos up there. We have a lot more coming. There's hours and hours of extra content that you get access to as a thank you for becoming a supporting member. So if you haven't checked that out before, take a look at what we got there. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.